This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With the June 30th deadline just 62 days away, fundamental characteristics of the transitional Iraqi government that's supposed to take power the day after are still uncertain. As yet, no one knows who will head the administration or what its powers will be. It is clear that the United Nations will play a critical role. After the bitter dispute that dates back to before the start of the war, the Bush administration has embraced the plan put forward by Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN special envoy to Iraq. He proposes a caretaker regime, headed by a president and two deputies and run by a prime minister. They would be technocrats rather than politicians and would only stay in power until elections are held next January. But amid the violence in Iraq, Washington hedged on what could be a critical issue. In testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee this week, John Negroponte, the proposed U.S. ambassador to Iraq, said that American commanders would retain the right to take action in Iraq where and when they see fit. The transitional government, in other words, would not have full sovereignty.
It's certainly going to be a lot more sovereignty than they have right now. We're going to work towards the day that the Iraqis can take greater and greater responsibility for their own security. But they're not in a position to do that at this particular moment.
Later in the program, an update on the situation in and around Fallujah, and we'll talk about the results of a new opinion poll in Iraq. But first, the UN's role in Iraq, past, present, and future. The prospects for a new Security Council resolution and the shape and powers of the transitional government. If you have questions about any of those, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can email us, TOTN@NPR.org. Joining us now from our bureau in New York is Edward Mortimer, a senior aide to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
How important an issue is sovereignty? Is this a potential deal breaker?
Well, I think the trouble with sovereignty is that it's a legal concept and its actual content can vary very much. I mean, the United Nations is composed of 191 sovereign states. But you could say that some are a lot more sovereign than others in the sense that they have more capacity actually to control what goes on in their territory. And in the case of the most powerful ones, like the United States, power to control a lot that goes on outside their territory. So I think Iraq on July the 1st will be legally a sovereign state with a government which is legally sovereign. But to what degree that government will actually be able to control events in Iraq, I think, is probably another question.
So is it your perception from members of the Security Council that if unless that government has control of the 150,000 or so foreign forces inside its borders, that it's not a legitimate or sovereign regime?
Well, I wouldn't wish to speak for the members of the Security Council who may well take different views on that point. I think that some will argue, at any rate, that if the government has chosen voluntarily to cede control of its armed forces to a foreign ally for the purposes of ensuring the security of the country, that that is something which is within its sovereign right to do. I am not a lawyer, and I wouldn't presume to take a view on the matter myself.
Going on to Mr. Brahimi's plan, it leaves open a large number of questions, such as how the members of this caretaker government will be selected, who will be part of the consultative assembly that will advise the government. What can you tell us about any of this?
Well, not a great deal. I think the reasons that Mr. Brahimi has not gone into more detail, mainly I think that he wants to preserve as much flexibility as possible. As far as possible, this should be an Iraqi process, and Iraqis should feel that this is a government that represents them and has been chosen by them. Now, since there isn't time to hold credible, free elections before June the 30th, they're going to have to wait for an incontrovertibly representative government, probably until January of next year. And what Mr. Brahimi, I think, is going to try and do is to work with Iraqis to produce a government of, as I think you said, of limited power that would keep the show on the road, so to speak, until those elections, without taking any decisions that would irrevocably change the course of Iraq's history or bind its successor.
To whom will he be speaking to try to identify these technocrats? Who will inevitably be seen as very important, at least in the interim period, that will be acceptable to all of the parties in Iraq?
I think he'll speak to as many people as he can, and that's been, you know, his approach all along. I mean, this would be, if he goes back in May, as I think is likely, that would be his third visit this year. Mm-hmm. And each time, you know, he's tried to meet as wide a spectrum of Iraqis as possible, people representing different currents of opinion, different ethnic groups, different religious groups, and so on. I think he hopes that out of that, he can distill a list of names which would be people who are generally respected, whatever their ethnic or religious background, but are seen as being people competent to do that particular job for a limited period of time.
When he talks of a structure of a president and two deputy presidents, many this is the same structure embraced in the Iraqi constitution, this would, a lot of people think, be a Shia president and a Sunni vice president and a Kurdish vice president. Would you be surprised if it were anything different than that?
I would be slightly surprised if it were different from that, because the Shia incontrovertibly are the majority. But on the other hand, there is a provision also for a prime minister. So I guess it is at least theoretically possible that the prime minister could be a Shia and the president could be something else. I think this is one of the things that will have to be worked out.
Yet finding one person that would be embraced by the entire Shia community, the entire Sunni community, the entire Kurdish community, they're distinctly driven into two different parties, that's not going to be easy.
It isn't going to be easy. I don't think anybody's pretending that it's going to be easy, but there isn't much alternative.
And he thinks he can get all of this done, needs, in fact, to get all of this done, in fact, not in June, but in May.
He's very keen, if at all possible, to do it by the end of May, because, as he says, you know, this government, once formed, will need time to prepare itself for assuming sovereignty on June the 30th. It will need to negotiate with the current occupying power, which, of course, will cease to be legally the occupying power on June the 30th. It will probably want to reach arrangements maybe with the United Nations and with particularly with the Security Council. So I think there's a lot to be said for having it set up a month before it actually has to take office.
And what would be the nature, character, and obviously you don't know the identity of the characters, but this consultative assembly, not elected, as you say, because elections aren't possible by that time frame, but again, would this just be a larger grouping of roughly the same kind of technocrats?
I imagine that that would have more sort of somewhat political people in it. I think the idea is that it would be a consultative assembly. In other words, that it's not going to be actually able to overthrow the government, but merely the government could use it as a way to sort of test ideas and see how far it could go and whether it would be going beyond its powers in taking certain kind of decisions. I imagine, but I don't know in detail what exactly Mr. Brahimi has in mind. And as I say, I think he's deliberately kept his ideas flexible and open to discussion.
And the other question about all of this is it's taking place in extraordinary conditions of violence. That's not to say that the United Nations has not helped conduct elections and similar kinds of you know, government building operations in conditions of violence, but as soon as these individuals are identified, aren't they going to have targets on their back?
I think there is indeed a risk of that, as of course does the United Nations. You know, you know what happened to the United Nations mission in Iraq last year. And when Mr. Brahimi and his colleagues visit Iraq, they have to be under very heavy guard. And of course, that's not a comfortable thing for somebody working on behalf of the United Nations who wants to be seen as impartial and open to all parties. But for his own safety, he has to accept protection from the occupying power, which no doubt is seen, at least by some people in Iraq, as being a party in a conflict.
Mm-hmm. We're inviting your calls. Our guest is Edward Mortimer, advisor to United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address, totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Ken, who's with us from San Diego in California.
Hi, Neil. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air, Ken. Go ahead.
I've been gradually seeing that the Bush government is inching forward and trying to give more and more role to United Nations. And my question is, how far does Mr. Mortimer think that the United States government would go and really try to give more power to United Nations and bring our soldiers back? Because I see a great danger in giving United Nations role, which is rather minor, rather than giving a major role and get out of the mess that we have created. Because I can't see Iraq being democratic in the sense we know in the West.
Go ahead, Mr. Mortimer.
Well, I think that one needs probably to distinguish there between power in the sense of authority in a political process and power in the sense of military power and the ability to ensure security in the country. I simply think the United Nations is not remotely a candidate for taking responsibility for security in the country. I mean, we do not have military forces at our disposal. Essentially, if military forces are deployed by the United Nations, it's because they are provided by member states, sometimes as a blue helmet peacekeeping force, but I don't think the conditions in Iraq are at all suitable for that at the moment, or in the form of a multinational force authorized by the Security Council to take action. And that, I think, is what we will probably see after July the 1st. I mean, some would say that we already see it because there are already Security Council resolutions on the books which encourage member states to provide forces to help stabilize the situation in Iraq. But this is in the rather anomalous situation where you also have an occupation as a result of a war, and indeed a war which seems to be still going on, by two countries, Britain and the United States. So there is an ambiguity about, are those part of the multinational force, or are troops sent by other countries part of the occupation? We hope that after July the 1st, that ambiguity will be removed, and that whatever troops are still there will have a sort of dual legitimacy. On the one hand, they will be accepted and invited by a sovereign Iraqi government, and on the other hand, they will have probably the authority of a new Security Council resolution. But that's assuming that all goes well, and of course all may not go well.
Does it mean that United Nations has to constantly ask for Bush government's permission before taking any kind of decision, or does it mean that they can only take decision where minor things are involved?
Well, at the moment, I think we have to accept the fact that the actual power in Iraq is held by the occupying forces, the Coalition Provisional Authority, composed of United Kingdom and the United States. And so to the extent that the UN is doing anything in Iraq, it has to be with their cooperation and consent. After June the 30th, the situation will be different because it will be a sovereign state with its own government. And if we have United Nations personnel in Iraq after that time, they will be there to help the sovereign government. And what they can do or not do would be essentially a matter for that government to decide.
Ken, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
And we just have a minute or so before the break, but I wanted to ask you, Mr. Mortimer, about the prospects of a new Security Council resolution. Mr. Negroponte, now the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., proposed to be the U.N. U.S. ambassador to Iraq, the man in charge there for the U.S. after July the 1st, has said that, you know, there's no draft yet. But what would you look forward to this resolution looking like?
Well, I think I already indicated what it would probably need to do, which is to recognize that Iraq will be a sovereign, or will have recovered its sovereignty on June the 30th, and that any military forces that remain there would be there by invitation of the sovereign government and with the authority of the Security Council, that any foreign forces that are not wanted by the sovereign government would not have the support of the Security Council and therefore would be illegitimate. But, I mean, that's my guess, and I'm sure there will be a lot of negotiations, and I think I read somewhere today that President Chirac even questioned whether there would be a new resolution. I think some member states are clearly apprehensive about giving legitimacy to this putative new government in Iraq, which will still be seen by many people as a continuation or a product of the occupation.
More of your calls with Edward Mortimer, an advisor to the UN Secretary General, after a short break. 800-989-8255, TOTN at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about the United Nations' role in Iraq. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest is Edward Mortimer, an advisor to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN at npr.org. And let's begin with an email question. This is from Craig Dremon in Redwood City, California. If the Iraqi people eventually decide they want to split up Iraq into three new countries, would the UN support that decision? And what's the UN's opinion about the possibility of that happening?
Well, of course, this has happened in some other countries. I mean, we've seen what used to be members of the United Nations, like Soviet Union and Yugoslavia, which have split up, sometimes with violence and sometimes without. It's seldom a completely happy process. I think perhaps the best example would be Czechoslovakia, where it was quite peaceful, and clearly both sides accepted it. I find that hard to imagine in Iraq. I think it would almost certainly be accompanied by a great deal of bloodshed. And I think probably a better bet is to for the people who live in Iraq with their various communities and identities to try and find a way of living together that recognizes those communities and identities without absolutely imposing them. Because in the last resort, the important thing is that individuals should be able to choose their own identity and how they wish to be represented in the political system.
Yet this is going to be a delicate question in the Iraqi constitution and indeed the arrangements of power to make sure that, this is a delicate question everywhere, I suppose, that the minorities feel adequately represented, and yet majorities don't feel as if they're bowing to a minority will.
I think that's right. And I mean, clearly, the particularly difficult question in the case of Iraq is the question of the Kurds, who do feel themselves to have a separate national identity. I think they, by and large, their politicians have accepted that they will probably not get away with becoming a completely independent state, if only because Iraq's neighbours would oppose that. But they certainly want the autonomy that they, the de facto, if you like, autonomy that they've enjoyed since the 1991 Gulf War, to continue in some form or other. And that's why they insisted on, in this transitional administrative law, on a clause which says that the new constitution could not be imposed if a two-thirds majority in any three governorates or provinces opposed it. And that would effectively mean the Kurds would have a veto. Of course, the Shia, and particularly Ayatollah Sistani, are very unhappy about that because they say that means that the will of the elected assembly might not prevail, and this current transitional law might become a permanent constitution because a relatively small minority of the people are blocking it. And that's going to be, I think, one of the big issues that will have to be sorted out when there are elections and when the Constituent Assembly meets next year.
Let's go now with DeWin, and he's joining us from Biloxi, Mississippi.
Good afternoon. My question is, how's the UN going to get legitimacy after starving them people for 12 years? You know, you see these babies dying at the hands of, holding up food. I mean, that's the reason they bombed the hotel or whatever.
I think he's referring, just to clarify for listeners, the Oil for Food program, which was administered by the United Nations in the long period between the end of the first Gulf War and the beginning of the second. Mr. Mortimer.
Well, I think he was actually referring to the sanctions,
yes,
which were imposed in 1990 and were kept in place until last year. The Oil for Food program, to which you referred, was an attempt to modify the effect of those sanctions for ordinary Iraqi people. And that operated from the end of 1996 onwards. And it did, in fact, of course, it didn't make Iraq an earthly paradise by any means, but it did actually make life easier for a lot of ordinary Iraqis. For instance, infant mortality went down drastically during that period and so on. As for the attack on the Canal Hotel, which was the UN headquarters in Baghdad last year, we don't know for sure who did that, still less what their motives were. I tend to think that their main motive was to demonstrate that the country was ungovernable under a foreign occupation and that any foreigners who were there under whatever flag should not consider themselves safe while that situation continued. But of course there must be resentment, I think understandable resentment, among Iraqis about the sanctions and the effect on their country, just as there maybe resentment by the same Iraqis or other Iraqis about the fact that the UN didn't do more to overthrow Saddam or to protect them against his oppression and violence and the chemical weapons that he used against the Kurds in 1987 and 1988 and all those things.
But how many children or people died because of malnutrition in Iraq? I guess we're never going to find the number because, you know, Saddam Hussein and them bookkeeping. But, you know, I mean...
Well, UNICEF did actually, with the Iraqi administration, did make estimates. And it's true that the infant mortality went up during the first period of sanctions in the early 1990s. And it came down again during the period when the Oil for Food program was in operation. So nobody's pretending that this is a pretty story. But I think that that program did at least do something to alleviate the pain which sanctions inflicted on the Iraqi people.
But it still doesn't answer the question, is there hostility in Iraq for the UN? I mean, they know they're hostile to us, but, I mean, do they see the UN as us?
I'm afraid that some of them do, because, of course, the UN came back into the country last year in the circumstances of the occupation, and I think probably many Iraqis considered it to be part of that occupation. Of course, they also know that it was through the United Nations and the Security Council that the United States and other countries agreed to sanctions and imposed sanctions. And indeed, it was the Security Council in 1990 that authorized member states to use all necessary means to free Kuwait from Iraqi rule. And in other words, it authorized a war against Iraq. So some Iraqis may indeed feel that the United Nations is part of their enemy. I think it's regrettable, but the indications that we've had right now is that most of them do not like having to deal directly with a foreign occupying power, and they feel that the United Nations, involvement of the United Nations, would give them some protection, and that the United Nations could act in some degree as a more honest broker. I mean, a more disinterested party, if you like, which could genuinely help Iraqis to come together and find an appropriate caretaker government. But clearly, Iraqis are very much divided on that issue, as on so much else.
DeWin, thanks you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's get another questioner on the line. This is Matthew, who's with us from Denver, Colorado.
Yes, hello there. How's it going?
Okay.
I have a couple of questions that have been at the forefront of my mind and really bothering me about the whole situation. I wanted to ask, is there any indignation in the UN that they're being asked to kind of like help us with our occupation whenever we went to war without their approval, without their blessing, and, I mean, combined with, you know, years of U.S. vetoes of U.N. resolutions designed, for example, to, you know, assist in putting, you know, peacekeepers on the ground in Palestine. I just want to know, is there any indignation that the U.N. is being asked to assist us? And I have another question, which is...
Matthew, why don't we go one at a time, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm Edward Mortimer.
Okay. Well, I think when you say in the UN, it's important to find out what exactly you mean by that, because in the UN could mean among the other members of the UN, the 190 members of the UN that are not the United States, or it could mean among people like myself who are officials of the organization.
Better terminology would be just the world community in general. Is there indignation that we're behaving?
Well, the world community in general, of course, there is indignation. I think, one doesn't want to generalize too much. There are many, many, it's a big world with many, many different opinions. But clearly,
let me just point out that Mr. Mortimer was quoted in the New York Times on Sunday saying it's quite nice when you've been generally dissed about your irrelevancy and then somebody suddenly have people coming on bended knee and saying we need you to come back.
But I think I should complete the quotation, because if you read the article rather than just the quote of the day, you will see that I went on to say, but it's also quite unnerving to be asked to go into a country where there is a great deal of violence and insecurity and a risk that you may be regarded as the faithful servant of a foreign occupying power. So I think it's a very bittersweet situation. But there, I was talking about the UN, meaning people like myself, officials of the United Nations, whereas I think your caller was talking about the other members, the world community at large.
Correct. Well, may I ask my other question?
If you make it quick, Matthew, I want to give other people a chance.
I've heard a lot of complaints within expatriate Iraqis in America saying that when they travel to Iraq, they find the borders wide open, like beyond the scope of what would be understood as just, you know, it's difficult. There's a lot of mileage to cover, et cetera. I was wondering, is the U.S. deliberately keeping the borders wide open so that they can continue to make the claim that there are foreign fighters inside of Iraq and kind of use that to link the Iraq occupation to the broader war on terrorism, which is so important to the administration? And if so, could the U.N. play a role in securing the borders to sort of, like, you know, mitigate that relationship?
I think that's what is known as a conspiracy theory. I certainly have no evidence that is the case. I'm sure that the occupying forces have their work cut out as it is, without manning every mile or kilometre of the frontiers. And the UN probably could not do that either. If it were asked to do that, again, it's member states who would have to provide the troops or the police that we would deploy. I should think it's a lot better bet to get Iraqis to do that themselves.
Matthew, thanks very much.
Thank you. I think you have another...
I just wanted to ask one more question let you go, and I appreciate it. And that is this is the Oil for Food program. As you know, there have been allegations that essentially the administration of this program allowed Saddam Hussein and his cronies to siphon off some $10 billion in unauthorized payments in the course of that period of time. And there are allegations that at least some of this money was provided in kickbacks to at least one United Nations official. I know that a team of people has been assigned to investigate this, headed by Paul Volcker, the former head of the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank. But I also know that Kofi Annan has had some strong things to say about these allegations in recent days. What's the situation now?
Well, I think the first thing I should say on that is to correct your figure of $10 billion. That figure comes from a report by the General Accounting Office. If you look at how it's arrived at... 5.7 out of that 10.1 billion, in other words, more than half, is attributed to smuggling of Iraqi oil. Now, this had nothing to do with the Oil for Food program. This is something that was going on from the moment sanctions were imposed. Of course, Iraq looked for ways to get oil out and to get money in. And the Security Council set up a multinational interception force to try and stop that being done by tankers in the Gulf. And it asked Iraq's neighbours to make sure the sanctions were observed. The fact is that these efforts were only very partially successful, and a lot of oil continued to leak out. Some of it the United States was extremely well aware of, because it was going out through Kurdistan, through the north of Iraq, into Turkey. The Kurds, who were allies and protégés of the United States and Britain, were taking what they called customs dues on that oil, and that was their main source of revenue. So I think this idea that, you know, this was something to do with the United Nations, you know, or still less to do with the Oil for Food program, which didn't start until 1996, is a bit overdone. Now, that leaves you with $4.4 billion, which the General Accounting Office say was indeed skimmed off by Saddam from the program. Now, you have to understand the mechanisms by which this could have been done. And mind you, I'm not vouching for those figures, but those are the figures the General Accounting Office arrived at. On the one hand, the oil was sold under the program, and it seems that for some of the time, at least, Saddam was deliberately setting the price as low as he could, so that as little as possible was paid into the UN account. But he could then give vouchers to his friends and cronies who would sell them on to companies who thereby were effectively paying an illegal premium on top of what they were paying into the UN account. Now, the UN oil overseers became aware in the year 2000 that this was probably going on. And they noticed that the price was being fixed constantly at the low end of the range. They drew that to the attention of the Security Council, and after a good deal of discussion and argument, towards the end of 2001, the Security Council decreed that from now on, Iraq must fix the price at the end of each month. The price had to be approved by the Security Council. Mm-hmm. So that meant the scope since you didn't know what the price was eventually going to be and it would be fixed in the light of what had turned out to be the market conditions during the month, you could fix it much more precisely, and the scope for that kind of hanky-panky, if you like, was much less. Now, on the other side, Iraq was importing not only food, but many other goods which were considered to be humanitarian necessities and which were being paid for out of this UN escrow account with the revenue from the oil sales. And there what happened is more or less the same thing, only in reverse. That
there was room for corruption, in other words.
Well, they chose suppliers who put their prices relatively high. So in terms of what was paid out by the UN escrow account, and that was quite high. But then these companies were paying some back secretly to the Iraqi regime. Kickbacks, exactly. Now, in some cases, again, it was much more difficult to detect that because of the wide range of commodities involved and all the varieties in market conditions. But in a number of cases, in a large number of cases, actually, UN officials did ask questions. And when they were not satisfied with the answers, they drew this to the attention of the Sanctions Committee, on which the US and the UK and the other members of the Security Council all sat. The US and the UK frequently put contracts on hold because they were afraid that the goods being imported might have military applications. At any rate, from 98 onwards, we couldn't find a single case where they had given us a reason for putting a contract on hold that they were unhappy about the price or about the quality of the goods being imported. So I think while there may well have been things done wrong by UN officials, and Mr. Volcker's inquiry will find that out, the member states of the United Nations, including the United States and the United Kingdom, were the architects of this programme, and it was a programme run under their supervision. So I think they will also have to take a lot of the blame for whatever was wrong with it.
So, yes, indeed. And of course, the story came out when the list of the people who got these concessions, these oil contracts from the Saddam government was published in Iraqi newspapers, I guess an indication of press freedoms in Iraq that we were not so accustomed to in previous years. Yeah.
But, you know, the list that has been published purports to be based on documents found in the Iraqi oil ministry. And we don't know exactly what the nature and status of those documents is.
The one which
names the head of the program, Mr. Sivan. I mean, this was a letter saying that the oil company such and such of Panama is indeed the one recommended by Mr. Sivan. Now, this is an Iraqi official writing to an Iraqi minister and quoting another Iraqi official in the Iraqi mission in New York. That last named Iraqi official was interviewed in a British newspaper yesterday, and he said, well, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't involved directly in oil sales. I do not have any knowledge that would directly implicate any individual. So I think Mr. Volcker and his panel are going to have to look at these documents very carefully
and
before
I'm afraid
they decide who is to blame for what.
Going to have to wrap this up. And Edward Mortimer, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much.
Edward Mortimer, a senior aide to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. He'll have more after a break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, join Ira Flatow on the next Science Friday for a look at spyware and what to do about it, plus the oldest evidence of controlled use of fire by our ancestors. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Today on Talk of the Nation, we're talking about Iraq. In just a minute, we'll take you to Fallujah for an update on the very fluid situation there. We're also going to hear about a new public opinion poll in Iraq, but joining us now is Michael Duffy, Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. He's with us from his office here in Washington. Good to have you on the program.
Nice to be here, Neil.
Just before the break, we were talking with Edward Mortimer, the advisor to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, and this is about the U.S.'s new receptivity to the involvement of the United Nations. This represents quite a turnaround, doesn't it, Michael?
Well, I don't know how new it is. I think you were beginning to see this as far back as November when the White House sort of recalled Bremer to Washington and quietly named its own man in Baghdad, Bob Blackwell. The administration has been moving toward a handoff much faster with all available help from the outside, which was the big change, I think, really, last November, when they said, look, maybe we'd like to get out of here by June 30th, at least in terms of being in charge of the political operation. And that was an automatic sign that they were going to have to bring in the UN. What's happened is, as we've gotten closer, they've relied more and more on the UN and its operators there, and so as we get, and I think as we get closer, Neil, you're going to see us, you know, support in any way the efforts to get the UN to take this over completely.
Is this sort of an admission that any government appointed or named by the United States is not going to have a lot of legitimacy? You need the UN's legitimacy for that?
Well, I don't know whether they're even going to name one anymore. I mean, what Mr. Brahimi has been doing is basically saying, you know, the U.S. idea, which is a year old, of a governing council that would run this thing, it doesn't work. At first he thought he was going to expand it. Then about 3 weeks ago he said, you know, we're just going to toss it out and do our own system. So, you know, the U.S. has been saying for now openly for a month, although, as I say, I think they've been acting more quietly for 6 months, has been saying openly for months, yeah, whatever Mr. Brahimi wants we'll support, because basically the U.S. wants to hand over this tar baby as quickly as it can.
What about the issue of sovereignty? Obviously, limited sovereignty is what they're talking about now. The U.S. would still control the security situation in Iraq, certainly between June 30th and the election of whatever Iraqi government is elected next year.
Well, I think that the question, first definition is handoff. What are we handing off, really? Last week, you're right, administration officials said the sovereignty that we hand off would be limited. They said, well, we're not going to hand over security. We're not really sure we're going to hand over whether you can make decisions about anything. You might have to run anything you decide by us. I noticed this week they wouldn't let the Iraqis decide on what kind of flag they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
That was not a good sign for sovereignty. I think this is all being worked out, and the reason, you know, you're confused and I'm confused and I think the Iraqis are confused is I don't think the administration exactly knows where its lines are yet. I think they're still trying to figure it out. They're hoping that Brahimi will, you know, cut as good a deal as they can accept. But I don't think that's all worked out. They have slowly, over the last couple of weeks, done everything they can behind the scenes to help Brahimi get his arms around the situation. It's a little known fact that Blackwell, like I said, the White House's envoy, its own envoy, has really gone over to Baghdad over the last 2 months to try to clear the decks and give Brahimi as much room as possible to come up with a new solution. It's not something the administration has spent a lot of time talking about publicly. They've done enough talking over the last 3 years about how they don't really trust the UN to run things, that it's a little awkward for them to be saying publicly, well, now we do.
And a little awkward when officials like Mr. Mortimer say, gee, it's nice to see them coming to us on bended knee.
Right. It hasn't been an administration that believes in nation building. It believed that it could solve this itself. It certainly did not believe going into this that it thought the UN had a big role to play. So it is a bit of a turnaround for them to be handing over this to Brahimi now. And if you ask them that, they'll say, well, we've always been for Brahimi, because they don't even want to sort of admit that they pulled the U-turn. But this has been a dramatic reversal over the last 6 months. There's no question.
Michael Duffy, thanks very much.
You bet.
Michael Duffy is Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. He spoke with us from his office here in Washington.